Good morning. I'm your host, yes, hostess Claudia Shamba, welcoming you to the January 21st, 2023 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, our guests run the gamut of water policy to Black community. We'll start with Max Gomberg, formerly staff to the California State Water Quality Resources Control Board, now an independent consultant giving us like a billable half hour plus on, he's a consultant on water affordability and resilience. With his decades of experience in water management, his seasoned takes will fly roughly at about 50,000, 70,000 feet, considering the consequential water policies being made on all levels of government. Then, in the second segment, we'll hear from local activist, art performer, maintainer, collector, and retired higher education administrator, Pauline Mary, about her new autobiography, Growing Up in the Ville in St. Louis, Missouri. It's recently released by Great Tales Told Well Publishing. With this genre of Black history is an uncanny education on lives lived in all kinds of communities. And last week, I closed with an announcement that University of Victoria, British Columbia Professor of Civil Engineering Heather Buckley would talk on microplastics, and we'll have to demur until late spring to hear from her. It'll be worth the wait, I'm promising you. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. My first guest is Max Gomberg, formerly staff to the California State Water Quality Resources Control Board. Now he's hung his shingle as independent consultant on water affordability and resilience. Max's career includes climate change mitigation strategist at the California State Water Resource Control Board, and previously public utility regulatory analyst at the California Public Utilities Commission, investigator at the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and his first career was as environmental education volunteer with the U.S. Peace Corps. He completed his Bachelor of Arts in Environmental Studies at the University of Chicago and his Master's of Public Policy at UCLA. I'm mainly going to toss some big general questions. I said we're going to fly 50,000 feet kind of land when we've got the executive office visiting California. But these are sweeping questions to calculate to get out of his way, to give him full rein to share with us his plain truth expertise about the most valued commodity we can address, water, ladies and gentlemen. So we're going to explore the actions that can be taken immediately and strategies to move past barriers and their imposing and approaches to hasten the application of promising policies and technologies. Max comes to us today from the Bay Area. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Max Gomberg.
Thank you for having me, Claudia. Good to be here.
Well, good. I mean, we've wanted Max on for quite a long time. He's made time for us today. First, if you could explain your official role where you resigned last July, and we're not going to read your letter, but it's an important document, actually. So could you give us that official role and how then merging into then how your consultancy has allowed you to advance what you could not state as a state employee?
My official role with State Water Board was to be a sort of internal strategic planner and manager. So under my purview was a small staff, and we covered everything from climate change policy to affordability to urban water management, particularly in times of drought, with conservation and other actions, and really, you know, focused on advising the five-member board, as well as sort of the larger state government of other agencies, people who work for the governor's office on how to manage water in a changing climate. It was pretty clear from the beginning of Gavin Newsom's tenure as governor that there were certain things they just didn't want to hear. They did not want to hear about the unsustainability of current agricultural water use in the state, about how we're really coming up to the precipice of major risk of price shocks, of major upheavals in our environment if we don't change the way that we use and manage water in this state, including unaffordability when all of the schemes that sort of the powers that be want to construct to try to maintain status quo water use, sort of when that bill becomes due. They just didn't want to hear it. They weren't interested in any type of policies to address it. And so as time went on, my role just became more and more constrained. I think people can understand when you're told no over and over and over and over again, you know, the level of frustration builds. And it came to a point where I realized I just couldn't do any good inside of state government any longer at that point. So that's really why I left. Since leaving, I've had the great opportunity of working with advocates in coalitions at both the national level and in California on critical issues of water affordability and climate resilience and equity, and being able to sort of be in partnership with organizations representing Black, Indigenous, people of color communities on the front lines across the country, and focused on how we build equity into water governance and water management has been a really tremendous experience, and I'm enjoying it a ton. Happy to talk about some of the specifics as we go forward.
As we go through this
policy.
That's
what I'm doing now.
So I want listeners to notice there's urgency in Max's word choice and phrasing, and it sounds like maybe in the governor's office and the administration, it's not just knocking edges off. It's taking whole paragraphs away from what's being shared with the public and the marching orders for gosh knows how many thousands of different water entities are. I mean, it's thousands of water entities in the state. So that's where messages are not only, it's crucial they go out right and clearly and intentionally, but that they go out to everybody receives that message. So now, what is, I mean, because with the recent weather we've had in California, everybody's been trying to put a kind of a label on the kind of gains of the water supply versus and the capacity and all that. So what right now, while you're watching the atmospheric rivers and all these other phenomena in our weather taking place, what's the biggest water take? I'm gonna just really give you this floor here. That the biggest water take that absolutely drives you to the edge, what's totally getting missed? Because everybody's been digesting the news on what's been happening with this weather. So what is it that you want to like get in front of this freight train and say, folks, this is what has been gained, what this is the capacity that needs filling in, and all of those messages, boom.
I think that what is getting missed is that we dodged a bullet. And if this winter had not delivered these atmospheric rivers that we had from late January until just a week ago, things would be really bad. Generally, in the state's urban areas, we don't feel the effects, aside from sort of conservation requests, when there are consecutive years of drought. But we're near the breaking point. That continues in the Colorado River Basin, although it's going to get a little better with the snowpack this year. But what I think people don't want to really face is that the precariousness of the system we have is really high. Things are much more in peril than I think people understand. It's not just that, our natural ecosystem, you know, our rivers and our fish populations that have sustained, you know, native peoples for centuries are in decline at the brink of extinction. It's that the food system, as it is sort of managed in California, is and really the Southwest, is incredibly vulnerable. and subject to really significant shocks that could sort of be on par with the type of things that we've experienced broadly in society. And what I mean by that is we're still in the midst of a global pandemic. You know, public health authorities, you know, far back knew that, you know, the risk of a global pandemic was fairly high. It was something that former President Barack Obama talked about during his tenure in the White House. But I think what wasn't appreciated was the challenge of how to manage the public messaging and sort of the public health response to a pandemic. And the analogy here is that when the time comes, when it comes to the drought that continues on and there is no saving series of atmospheric rivers, what is that going to look like? And what that's going to look like if we don't make some changes soon is price spikes in basic commodities, milk, basic fruits and vegetables, and a food crisis in the way that really hasn't been experienced in this country since the Dust Bowl. I'm really trying not to be hyperbolic here, but the way that agriculture is managed and controls water, and the way that we have refused as a society, as government, to rein in some of that unsustainable use is really increasing that risk of wide-scale sort of systemic shock. And I think most people don't appreciate that.
So everybody noticed that the urgency, the clamoring here, that is so what has to get done on this program in every single area of policy making. So it's real fast here, really, really fast, because I can't believe how much we need to cover here in such a short time, is that the GRACE satellite system that measures the kind of depth of the amount of the groundwater stored around the world. So I'm not sure if you watch do you watch the GRACE satellite readings?
I look at them from time to time.
From time to time. And so I'm just wondering if the governor's office, if they, you know, they go, well, it's really bad over that part of the Pakistani, Chinese, Indian border, but it's not that bad here yet. But, you know, but it's that's data we're getting. We're getting it almost, it's daily, almost hourly, though, right? That gives us a read. What is the groundwater storage actually at, which is the part we cannot see? You were talking about the surface water, but the groundwater is the part we can't see. And that's what GRACE is tracking. So, but we're getting data all the time, daily, no?
We are. And we also have the visual data from parts of the state Central Valley, right, where there's been so much land subsidence that you can actually measure it in feet over the decades, where even the infrastructure that was built to transport surface water, the canals, right, are cracking.
Yes.
And because of all that land subsidence from groundwater overpumping, and of course all the communities that have had their wells go dry because of the continued over-extraction of groundwater. So we've got a lot of data sources. We're not lacking data. And that brings me to, I think, what's an important point to emphasize, which is that when I started with the state about 15 years ago, the mode of sort of climate operation, if you will, was a lot of what I will describe as plan and assess, right? We need to sort of develop scenarios for future climates, assess options for responding, write reports, you know, analyze data. We're past the point where spending a whole lot of time on additional planning and assessment is our best use of time.
It's time to use the 70,000 foot analogy. It's time to jump out of the plane. Let's do it. Just move on it. Hop on this crisis.
That's right.
Okay.
You know, speed really is the key to mitigating some of the worst outcomes.
And everybody but the pilot needs to be jumping out. We all are all worked. So for those of you just joined us, my guest is Max Gomberg. He was on the California State Water Quality Resource Control Board. When he's speaking to us now with all the autonomy and the expertise and seasoned experience as now an independent consultant on water affordability and resilience. So if we could race through some of the best practices I've heard you speak about, we could just start with giving a nod to talk about quickly the cultural change that's needed. I mean, there are so many people. It must drive you the same kind of level of insanity that I do when I see people just casually just running water on where you talk about the inside and the outside use. But so the cultural change is so important and fundamental, and so that's the beginning of best practices.
Absolutely. I mean, there's still a lot of waste in our urban areas, and that waste is particularly significant because, right, that's highly treated water. In many cases, it's pumped from a long way away. There's a lot of energy required to move it and treat it. We don't have the luxury in California's climate, particularly the way it's going, to waste that water and to use it on irrigation, sort of ornamental high water use plants, in particularly
this is in England
grass.
Yeah. Right,
but urban use really is not where the biggest change needs to happen. The biggest change needs to happen in the agricultural sector,
and that's cultural. Agriculture.
That's not just cultural. It's also about sort of the exercise of power. And what I mean by that is we as a society are moving away due to cultural shifts, but also due to a changing power dynamic where the oil and gas industry no longer can just sort of steamroll any attempt at a transition away from their products. In agriculture, it's more complex, right? We're not transitioning away from agriculture, per se, but there has been what I consider to be an unwritten policy in the United States, and this has been the case and is ongoing, which is the policy of government with respect to agriculture has been to keep food as cheap as possible, and we need to move away from that. It's not sustainable, particularly in water-constrained regions. It's really not even sustainable in the Midwest. But the idea that agriculture and water use associated with agriculture is one of the areas where the government sort of takes a light touch and essentially lets people grow whatever they want, wherever they want, with however much water they use, according to rules or lack of rules in the case of groundwater until recently, but rules that were derived from sort of colonial land grab practices, hundreds of years ago, that's really problematic. And that's got to change.
Yes. And in among it's part cultural change and it's policy, as you've talked in seminars I've heard you speak, is water conservation should be treated as a new supply. And we don't get that in the messaging from leaders in the state and with the feds.
That's true. The true powers at water agencies are generally people who have been trained as engineers and financial managers. And they like the comfort and certainty of stuff that is built and stuff that is, from their perspective, reliably measured. And conservation has never been seen as supremely reliable. And when you're focused on conservation, you don't get to build shiny new stuff. So that is a cultural shift that absolutely needs to accelerate.
And I've had conversations with, when I hear that bias from an engineering mindset, that sort of the traditional business model. So I guess I'm going to, in the interest of time and while we're talking about this, that assumption is when we see the Inflation Reduction Act, the Build Back Better legislation, that the people that were involved in crafting the legislation and that are assuming the funding that's come out of, it's quite sizable funding, it's still those same people with those same engineering and financial planning biases, though. Is that what you're seeing, to maybe our shared horror?
It is, and to some extent, that reflects the fact that, you know, water is always sort of a secondary or tertiary concern when it comes to these big bills, but they're really focused on, you know,
right,
energy, housing, transportation. And in terms of the actual sort of global greenhouse gas reductions, that's completely valid.
Backwards, yeah.
But it does lead to the same type of bias because, right, yes, we do need to build a lot more renewable energy and transmission and storage and, right, and we need to build housing, right? We have a housing crisis in this state. And part of that is ensuring that we can build more housing and make it affordable for people. And that requires a state intervention. And the problem is that doesn't translate to water, right? In water, we don't need to build more pipes, canals, reservoirs, you name it, right? We actually need to overall reduce use and make smart investments where they make the most sense, like recycling more of our wastewater. But that's where the translation from sort of the energy housing space of we need to build to water doesn't work. Because in water, we don't need to build. That is not where we are as a state.
And those that are involved in crafting that legislation and as I said, receiving the resources, the bias is going to be about large centralized kinds of infrastructure versus what you talk about is more distributed infrastructure for managing water. So that's a behemoth barrier for solving this.
Absolutely. And it's why the attempts at sort of getting around that barrier, like Measure W in LA that funds some stormwater management and capture are so important. And we need more of those. And frankly, we need major sort of financial reforms as well. We need to do away with Prop 13, which limits property tax collections. In water in particular, we need to do away with Prop 218, which limits the ability of water agencies to support their low-income customers and develop rates that are truly affordable.
So that's how large the barriers are, is even reversing Prop 13. And we could just simply ask for amendments to how the commercial properties are, the property tax calculations are. But that's, you know, that was on our ballot, I think, in 2020. It didn't fly. So I'm just going to quickly here ask you to give us a thought. What would you do if you were with President Biden when he was at his very carefully choreographed appearance in Northern California, it was at Capitola last week, and right after that, Vice President Harris was at the Tujunga Pass area. What quickly, you have, I don't know how much time you want, tell us how much time you want with them. What would you say you have their ear? There's nobody else around.
I think the first thing I would say is the federal government needs to stop supporting these pipe dreams, these zombie water projects, the Delta Tunnel, the sites and Temperance Flat reservoirs, you know, the big, that they have to, when they say the era of that type of infrastructure is over, they have to mean it. And if the federal government withdraws its support, the state government is not going to be able to go it alone. And with the money that we will save from not making those huge infrastructure investments, we can do a lot of other critical things, conservation, local supplies, like recycled water and stormwater, you know, a just and equitable transition for land that really shouldn't be farmed anymore to support our river systems and our groundwater. So that's number one. And then number two, right, where the federal government really needs to step up in two areas. One is providing the financial support that it really hasn't since the 1970s for critical basic health and safety infrastructure, drinking water treatment, wastewater treatment, and helping to keep water rates affordable so that everyone, and in particular people who are struggling economically in our deeply inequitable society, you know, aren't facing the choice of having to pay for water or other basic necessities, or, you know, falling behind on their water bill and losing access to what is really, you know, critical for life. And then number two is, so that's where the federal money comes in. And then number two is really changing the way that the federal government approaches sort of disasters in a context of climate change. Right, we have the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, which, you know, generally just pays out money in certain instances after disasters, right? Hurricanes and floods and whatnot. You know, maintains insurance programs like the flood insurance program. All of those need to be changed to reflect our climate reality, and the federal government really needs to make, and they're going in this direction, but they need to go a lot further. They really need to focus on having federal agency response that isn't just after the fact, right? We need the federal government, which is the biggest land owner and manager in the West, to adopt native fire management practices on federal forest lands. We need to change the way FEMA operates. So there are, and we need to change the way that the federal government funds water infrastructure. So there are a number of things they can do that would really move the needle. They can't do it all alone. We need the state to do things differently as well. But the federal government does have a big role to play.
So instead of the post-crisis thoughts and prayers, it would be the strategic thoughts and dares to get this up and running here. So we've talked about, if you have a moment to address, who are the brightest California legislators? You sort of disparage some of the people that are on the California Problem Solvers Caucus, the Problem Solvers Foundation, but just who are the bright lights in the California legislature that we should be following, briefly?
I think it's the people who are new to the legislature. They bring a lot of energy and willingness to say, if California is really going to be a progressive state, we have to make our laws sort of in line with our values, right? We have to walk the talk. So that's people like Alex Lee, like Ash Kalra, like Isaac Bryant, and others who are really leading the charge on making California values in a really progressive approach and really putting the laws and policies and budget choices in place that are sort of, how shall I put it, that are doing more than just small incremental changes, because that's not what we need right now.
Well, I'll look them up.
We need big scale transition.
So I'll look them up and I'll work with their community radio platform so that, you know, we can get some of this done and raise the profile and laud them and encourage them to do that. Well, folks can bone up, as we're closing today, folks can bone up more on the water policy and management. Tomorrow's going to be another of the monthly installments, the Southern California Water Dialogue. I don't have a pithy, SouthernCaliforniaWaterDialogue.org is the link to sign up. You have to sign up to be able to go to the remote visits of those, and I always learn a lot. There may be a very strong institutional bearing, but there is a lot of follow-up with critical takes if it's too state and too institutional. So the dialogue is held up there. So I want to mention that. And that's where I first got a chance to hear Max as he had transitioned away from his state post. So this has been really helpful, Max. Maybe you want to come back. I can give you a whole hour about, you know, maybe an update on some solid policy moves. I'm not sure. But I thank you for the billable hour today on Ask a Leader.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Claudia. And yeah, I'd be happy to come back.
Okay, thank you for that. My guest was Max Gomberg, and he is the, who's, as I said, formerly with the California State Water Quality Resource Control Board, and now he's a consultant with the Water Affordability and Resilience. We'll be right back with next guest, local activist, retired higher ed administrator, Pauline Mary, about her new autobiography, Growing Up in the Ville in St. Louis, Missouri. Aguachibebe, camera. Aguachibebe, aguachibebe, camera. Welcome back to the show. It's my pleasure to bring our next guest and actually a friend of mine, Pauline Mary, about her new autobiography, Growing Up in the Ville in St. Louis, Missouri, five stories about a little black girl growing up in the 1940s and 50s in the very segregated St. Louis, Missouri. That's part of the longer title. Pauline Mary earned her Bachelor's of Science in Nursing from University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri, and found her calling later as an educator. She taught at Jordan High School in L.A., then moved into several roles in the California Community College system as a teacher, then a counseling and finance administrator. She was at Los Angeles Community College District, the Irvine Valley College, and West L.A. College. She retired as the provost of the Pacific Coast campus of Long Beach City College. Her community services include Women for Orange County, and she's where she served on the board, and lecturing at the Ollie class on African-American women's history at Cal State Fullerton. As an adult learner of the cello, she performs in the Southern California Philharmonic and serves on their board of directors. She served the larger community as a member of the OCTA Measure M Oversight Committee, and she's currently on the Orange County Grand Jury. She comes to us today from her home of 26-some years. It's loaded with music notes and art. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Pauline Mary.
Hello there.
Hello.
Claudia.
Hello. Well, congratulations on a remarkable read. And on several different levels, we're acquainted now more than ever. So I want you to just sort of post us your grandchildren, among them your grandson, asked, he wished that you would put down your stories in print. And I just want to say, in a, it was sort of a lovely piece in the Sunday New York Times Magazine by Oliver Huang that he was quoting an elder who suggested, and it's sort of like it's a through line for your book and the sequel that you're promising us. But the quote was, for people to live their lives as if it were a story they would tell their grandkids. And that that is the story. So there's some interesting elements, and you take your pick. I don't like to get in the way of storytellers. The storytellers get this mic. So there's your voice, there's your memory, there's your message, and there's your audience. So those are always going on, and it's very particular. As we could say, the voice that you're speaking in two different voices. It's an interesting technique. Tell us about that.
Well, when I started writing, I would put words down, and somehow I wanted to explain to the readers what was going on. So I just started putting on my teacher cap and explaining issues that were coming up in the stories as I told them. So I found that really fun to do, and I don't see it very often in other books. And in the book, it's distinguished not only by my voice, but also by the type font that is used. So the reader can see the little girl's voice in one font and the adult's voice in another. It seemed important to me to get the situation, the story, what was going on at the time in a broader environment other than just my little tiny life going to music lessons and the like. So that's how that came about. It just was a really natural flow for me. I didn't even have to think about it, including my adult voice as I told my story.
And about what you recall, there's so many instances. You are incredibly specific. And so I'm not going to get into why you were that specific, but I want to know how you were able to be that specific. Were you, did you, because you don't talk about keeping a journal. You talk about writing down some research projects that were, it was really fascinating. But how did you recall everything that you put in there?
Well, some of it might be, it's mostly factual, but there were some embellishments there. But it was very clear in my mind. I can see, at this moment, I can see me sitting on the front steps. I can see me walking down the streets in the Ville. I can see me going to Tandy Park. I actually, it's amazing how strong my memory is in that. And also, as I wrote, I was able to visualize. I did a lot of walking. We had no car. And so the places that I went just stuck with me. And I also like being alone. So when I was, for example, walking to school, I was walking by myself. And those memories, the smells, the things that I saw just stuck with me today, still to today. And I actually went on Google while I was writing to see if some of those places that I remembered were still there. Well, they aren't. And so I'm so glad that I have this good memory of those places and things that I did. So it's just a fortunate thing in my own mind.
There is a synapse that you bring up that I find very interesting, and maybe when people no longer sort of ambulated on their own and they're driven and riding around more, is that could be lost memory, that your walking around activated, you know, what you were thinking and cognitively processing. So there's a rich trove that gets lost if people are just getting around by some kind of a motor. So that's something to be very concerned about. So and then the message the audience. You're writing this with a particular format that gives us a thought that you're maybe talking maybe to book groups, maybe you're talking to students who need this sort of scaffold to think as deeply and go even deeper from where you start us with this. So talk about that scaffold and the audience you're trying to reach by what your scaffold is signaling
sure.
to us.
Sure. When I first started writing, my audience felt to me like it would be preteens, and particularly in particular girls. But as the questions at the end of each chapter were for, I had this notion that, you know, homeschoolers would pick up on it. I had a very narrow view of this book getting out. I was picturing homeschoolers and helping instructors, teachers, with their lesson plans, if you will. Here were the questions ready to go to engage students. But I'm finding that adults are reading it, and I had the funny, a friend of mine actually answered one of the questions in chapter one, and she really dove into, I think it was name something like, what would you like to do other than what you're doing now, or what would you like to be when you grow up? And she decided she had thought she wanted to be a somebody who does stuff with furnitures, and so she went on YouTube and checked it out, you know, and she said, nope, I don't think I want to do that anymore. So my audience is varied, and I think it's suitable for kids in elementary school, high school, girls, and book clubs. You know, they might sit down and want to talk and want to explore the life of this person, some of them who know me and most who won't.
Right. That's I'm in that group. Know you, not not extensively, but know you to a certain extent. So for those of you who've just joined us, my guest is local artist and activist and a retired higher education administrator, Pauline Mary, about her new autobiography, Growing Up in the Ville in St. Louis, Missouri. It's released by Great Tales Told, Well Publishing. So I don't want to spoil I want people just to have what you, what story you tell. I want it to unfold for them. There is, in a sense, a spoiler alert. There's like this big aha, and I go, wow, that's where she's going. So I want, instead of me doing any spoiler alerts, is there a passage? We only have time for one, unfortunately. Is there something you would like to read for us while we're together today?
Let me see. I think I do. Let's see. Here's one at the very beginning of the book. It goes like this. It's in the prologue. One summer when I was about 10, I went with my parents and my sister to Boston to visit the relatives of my father's first wife, Jackie Jackson, who, by the way, was the second black grad from Radcliffe College. Anyway, we were in Boston at a busy, busy intersection where I, trying to keep up with everybody, started to cross the street. Just then, a car came toward me, almost hitting me, but a slight white young man pushed me safely as the car sped by. I was surprised but thankful that I was now out of danger. The man took off too quickly for us to thank him. My mother turned to me and said, "Pauline Estelle, that man saved your life. I believe you were spared because you were meant to be here to do something important." And then just a little bit more from the epilogue. On a trip I took to work as a volunteer in Arusha, Tanzania, in Africa, when I arrived at the Kilimanjaro Airport in Tanzania, the officer, looking at my passport, said, "You're 75 years old."
Mm.
"Yes, yes, I am." "And you are alone." "Yes." He said, 75-year-old women don't travel alone. My age, it turns out, was of special interest because at that time, the lifespan of men in Tanzania was 52.
Oh.
The lifespan of women was 54. To them, and apparently to this customs agent, I wasn't a wonder. "Well, I do," I said. The next day, I found myself on the back of a motorcycle squeezed between the driver and a guide, both of whom I had just met, while riding along the bumpy road to hike in a hidden waterfall, I said to myself, "No one in the whole wide world knows where I am." And I was quite all right with that.
Oh, that's, thank you. Thank you so much for that read. Well, I'm interested. Sometimes when I saw the young girl voice, sometimes I thought, now, wait a minute, this, I'm not sure this observation isn't the adult coming through. And, but I'm interested in, this is out of the book. I mean, apart from what is published, I'm interested in your adult voice about your mother, her social choices, her parental approach, her marriage. I mean, you talk about those things to some extent, but there's something going on with how she was raising you, and it looking back now as an adult about what her choices were versus how she lived her own life. There's a very interesting slight tension in those kind of worlds there merging.
Indeed, indeed. My mother was older. She had me, I think she was 39. Well, nowadays, lots of women are having children at 39 and stuff. But back then, there weren't that many. So she was an older parent. She had gray hair, even though she was very pretty. And she had dimples. And she loved my sister and me just enormously. But her marriage to my father, I don't think was a very good one. So she got an education. She was educated, and one time she was asked to be a dietitian down the street from us at Homer G. Phillips Hospital. And my father told her, "No, you cannot work. No wife of mine is going to work." And Claudia, even as a child, I was so sad for her. We didn't need her at home. I knew on some level that she would be much better off. So as a consequence, what she told me and my two other sisters over and over and over again, don't ever be in a position where you are beholden to a man to support you. Not once did my mother say to me, well, some man will come along and you won't have to work. Never came from her lips. I think about why she was so shy. I think about why she didn't have friends. But to this day, I cannot really parse what her inner life was like at all. All I know is that my sister and I and my father were the beneficiaries of her love and the care that she gave us and the good food that she prepared for us and the notions that she had about the world. She would readily share those ideas with us. And so that's how my sisters and I grew up with this marvelous woman. Although she was shy, didn't go out, had a brain, and shared her insights with us. So I think about her a lot still, and wish I could have more time with her.
Right. Oh, yes. Well, so there's a lot of subtleties in how she nurtured you. I don't think I'm spoiling anything here. It's that... So that you took on some, I'm not going to say what they are, because I want people to read this growing up in the Ville. So you made some decisions, some choices. And when you returned to share with her, her curiosity was the sort of subtle endorsement of what you did without getting her permission first. Does that stay with you?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
Does that stay with you, that subtle approval? It wasn't she said, oh, you need to be curious, you need this. No, you were that, you lived that, you exercised that, and she approved of how that, and she sort of tried to have you unpack, well, what did you find out kind of thing. So that,
right.
So there were maybe it was the subtlety of her parental approach that was her legacy.
I don't remember her once saying, you shouldn't have and you can't, and she never imposed those kinds. There were some other restrictions that she did, but being out there in the world, she may have even envied me for that matter, as we're chatting now. She may have delighted in the fact that I stepped out the door and disappeared for hours and hours, you know,
and brought the world there back to you. Well, we're going to have to close. I think what I'm going to do is this sort of an odd and kind of a global probe here is you talk about fish not realizing they're in water, and you and your childhood experience were you were that fish. You didn't realize you were in water. When, Polly, Mary, when did you leave the water? When did you know that you were in the water and you're not in the water anymore?
Well, Claudia, I think I always knew we were where I was in the world. It was hard not to know the differences that existed between blacks and whites. It was hard not to know about where we lived. It was hard not to know that, or as Martin Luther King said about churches, he said churches are the most segregated entities on Sundays in the entire country. So it was hard not to know. But I heard a woman from a similar background, but she was in the Deep South. She held it, and I think I do too, that the whole notion of racial segregation and living in the Ville and having to step out of the Ville was kind of background noise. This is what you lived with. This is what you knew. This is what you saw how other adults navigated their world. So it was a surprise. Oh, we tested the boundaries, but being in the United States, being in Missouri, you cannot not know your circumstances, and that was certainly true for me. So I think that I understood the circumstances didn't embolden me necessarily, but it didn't stop me from doing the things and going the places that I wanted to go.
Well, thank you for all of that. And Polly Mary, there is a new friend I've made, Dr. Mary Marshall. She may be live streaming us out of Harlem right now, and she's been very involved in completing family histories, the generations uh-huh. that aren't around, so that the generations living are having a bridge to that family history. So my wish is that we could have both of you interacting perhaps later on in February. So I so hope we can do that. So I want to thank you, Polly Mary, for being on Ask a Leader with your new autobiography. And you say at the end that there's a sequel coming from your high school life. So it's called Growing Up in the Ville in St. Louis, Missouri. Thank you, Pauline, for being on Ask a Leader today.
Thank you so much, Claudia, for having me.
Thank you. Well, that's my wrap. Next week, my guests are Earth System Science Keith Moore and his colleague, and then Paul Vanous and Tina Rivers-Ryan, both curators at the soon-to-be open installation at UCI's Beale Center, Difference Machines, Technology and Identity in Contemporary Art, opening this Saturday, running through April 29. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening.